Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover on Colfax. Thank you so much for coming out and supporting our author events, and thank you so much for supporting independent bookstores. We truly appreciate it. It is a great pleasure for me to introduce Gillian Flynn because this book, it takes off. I had never read you before, and I started reading this book, and I thought, oh my gosh, I better hold on. And this is funny because Gillian grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, and she went to the University of Kansas to get her undergraduate degree in English and journalism. And then she went to Northwestern University and discovered she was too wimpy to become a crime reporter. And I find that funny with now what you're writing. But anyway, so she did a long stint at Entertainment Weekly magazine and was a great TV critic and got to go all over the world. But then in 2006 with her debut, Literary Mystery Sharp Objects. It was an Edgar Award finalist, winner of two of Britain's Dagger Awards, and the first book ever to win multiple daggers in 1 year. And then her second novel in 2009 was a New York Times bestseller, Dark Places, and won several awards. And then Gone Girl, I know, is right up on top of the indie bestseller list immediately. So it'll just continue climbing all the bestseller lists. That's my prediction. So her work has been published in 28 countries now, and she lives in Chicago with her family, and we are just so pleased to have her. Please welcome Gillian Flynn.
Well, thank you very much for that lovely introduction. And thank you for having me at Tattered Cover. It's really exciting to be here. I've always wanted to come. I've always heard stories about it from other writers over the years about what a great bookstore and what a wonderful community it is. So I'm very, very happy to have made it. And thank you for coming out on a Tuesday night. It really means a lot for an author to... You have that moment where you peek in the room and, you know, you hope for a few people to show up. And so if you ever wonder if it makes a difference, it really does. So I thought what I would do is just talk a little bit about kind of my writing process and then the first couple of books and a little bit about Gone Girl. And, you know, I'd love to turn it over to the audience. I'd much rather hear what you want to hear than for me to talk. I am a writer by trade, so I spend most of my days by myself in my basement office. So if I seem strange to be out of my cage right now, it's I'm not used to just chatting. I often spend entire days not talking at all. So if I start rambling or like I'm doing now, or just give me a get the hook sign and I will move on. But I did grow up in Kansas City, Missouri, and had just always wanted to be a writer. My parents collected this kind of book that you filled in, you know, as a child of the 70s, and it's very like 70s kind of style book, like when I grow up I want to be. And from third grade on I wanted to be either a farmer or an author. That's what I filled in every single time. And I'm not sure entirely how I thought I was going to become a farmer, since we killed even basic house plants, but that was definitely a possibility for a while. But I always loved writing. I had two parents who were incredibly creative people. I have two parents, but they raised me very interested in books and movies. My dad's a film professor. My mom taught reading at a college level. So I spent a childhood that was surrounded by books and movies and was always encouraged to, you know, explore and write and create. And it was a very, very nice way to grow up. And you know, went on and did think I would go to journalism school. And having always had a natural interest in poking under rocks and figuring out the dark side of things. Despite my pretty nice, easy Kansas City existence, I always had an attraction to the dark side, and really did think I would be a crime reporter and would be this kind of break open cases and really nose around, and, you know, it would be kind of this cross between, you know, Woodward and Bernstein, but a lady, and, you know, I was really going to transform the industry. And I discovered very quickly that I am a kind of naturally slightly shy person and unassertive, and that does not lend itself to crime reporting very well. I was at Northwestern, and they send you out on, you know, basic real crime, you know, you're a stringer for local newspapers, and they sent me out to cover a strike. And it's a strike. People actually want to talk to you and have their voices heard. And I couldn't even do that. I stood on the side for about 3 hours going, excuse me, I'm... like, what do you want to make? No, I'm sorry. I don't mean to bother you, but... And I thought, I kind of went home that night and was like, I'm going to have to rethink my strategy. But luckily, I did, you know, grow up as a real movie geek and book lover, and... there was a magazine called Entertainment Weekly, and so I switched my sights and thought, you know, I'd love to work for that magazine. You know, they had such a good sense of humor and wrote about pop culture in a very, very smart way, which I appreciate more and more these days. You know, it wasn't so, you know, celebrity oriented. It was very much, you know, how movies are made, and, you know, very respect for filmmakers and authors and all that. You know, it's one of the only massive magazines in the country that can do, you know, a 3-page spread on a writer. Like, how often do you see that anymore? So I really set my sights on there, and was able to get a job out of Northwestern and worked my way up there as an editorial assistant, and you know, just had such a good time there. I covered movies for them for, I was there 10 years, and I covered movies for about the first 6 years, and was their TV critic the last four. And I wrote, started writing Sharp Objects while I was covering film. And so I didn't have a book contract. I didn't have an agent or anything like that. I just knew that I wanted to write a book. And so I would be on these film sets. I have a very distinct memory of being coming home from a very sun-drenched, insane day on the set of Jackass the Movie in Florida somewhere. I don't even know where we were in Florida, and coming back and like writing an incredibly dark scene from Sharp Objects, and, you know, just wrote that way. It really was a labor of love on evenings and weekends and whenever I could, and, you know, it would disappear when I would get busy for months at a time, and I would kind of go back to it. And I always feel like I owe a credit to Dennis Lehane, who is one of the great writers of our day, because until then, I had tried to write a story, and I knew wanted to write a story about a very toxic mother-daughter relationship, and I wanted to write about kind of female rage and aggression and how that's channeled very differently from male, and I just couldn't figure out how to do it. I would always bog down. It would be a series of scenes of people in rooms talking. It was so boring. And I read Mystic River when I started it when I got home from work, and I finished it about at dawn, you know, and then went back to work. And I thought, I think I know what to do. I make it a mystery. You know, Dennis Lehane, Mystic River is it's not just a mystery. It's about neighborhood and family and blood ties and loyalty and marriage and revenge. And that was that moment where I thought, oh, this is how I do it. So, wrote Sharp Objects, and then, you know, Dark Places kind of had already been percolating a little bit. I've always had an interest in true crime and how we process true crime and how we make certain celebrated cases. We get so attached to them in many ways. I mean, I'm at least speaking for myself, and what that kind of means about us for the cases that we pick and the cases we become fascinated by. And so having grown up on the Kansas border, had always had a fascination with In Cold Blood, and read that at way too young an age. And so I'd kind of just started with the idea of there are, you know, bodies of a family found in a Kansas farmhouse and what happened. And the time setting's different. I said it during the you know, my childhood time, which is the Kansas farm bust and all, you know, the Willie Nelson and Farm Aid, and it was about a family who was really struggling, and wrote that. And if anyone's read Dark Places, it's told from three different points of view. So it's told from Libby, this little girl who's the survivor of the family massacre in present day, and it's in the past of the brother that she accuses of the crime and the mother who is end up being murdered. And the biggest lesson I learned from that book was to, and this is going to sound very authory, but to let your characters be themselves and to not force them, because I was very, very self-conscious of being worried about writing another dark female narrator. And, you know, I don't want to do that. I don't want to cast as that. I want to try something different and prove to people, you know, I can do any other kind of voice I want to. And so I wrote Libby, who, again, had survived her family's massacre, then fingered her brother for the murders, and has now gone through present day. And she was, I'd written the entire first draft with her as this incredibly proactive, cheerful, loving, happy, balanced, sane person, and just a joy to be around. And she was going to get to the bottom of solve this case. You know, she'd realize that maybe perhaps her brother didn't do it and was going to look into it. And my husband, who is my first and best critic and reviewer, I gave it to him, and he said, let's sit down. Let's sit down. And we'll open a bottle of wine. I knew it was going to be bad. He said, you know, the narrative from Ben, the brothers, is fine. That's very solid. And the narrative with the mom is definitely working. And he said, let me ask you about Libby. Do you like Libby? I said, and I hadn't realized it. I all of a sudden, it was like she was someone I knew. I was like, oh my God, I can't stand Libby. She's such a goody two-shoes. She thinks she knows best. Blah, blah, blah. She's so boring and can't stand her. And he said, yeah, you can tell that you don't like her and that you don't like writing her. And so then we opened another bottle of wine, and I deleted all her scenes. I didn't try to salvage anything. I never try to salvage anything if I know it's wrong, because it's too great a temptation to try to weave together stuff that doesn't work. And I feel like you can always tell when a writer is trying to take that shortcut. So I just deleted her entirely and gave myself a little time, and I actually came up with that the opening line of the book, which is, I have a meanness inside me real as an organ. And I thought, oh, I've figured out Libby Day. And I would like to get into Gone Girl just by reading the opening paragraph, if that's okay, just to give you a taste of it. And it is told from the point of view of Nick Dunn. And this is a story of kind of the mystery of marriage, and marriage is a mystery. And it kind of takes off from that old phrase, no one knows what happens inside other people's marriages, and takes it to that next step, which is, do you really know what happens in your own marriage? And do you really know who you are, even? And if you don't know who you are, how can you have a marriage? And who do you trust? So this is Nick on the morning of his fifth wedding anniversary. When I think of my wife, I always think of her head, the shape of it to begin with. The very first time I saw her, it was the back of the head I saw, and there was something lovely about it, the angles of it, like a shiny, hard corn kernel or a riverbed fossil. She had what the Victorians would call a finely shaped head. You could imagine the skull quite easily. I'd know her head anywhere. And what's inside it, I think of that too, her mind. Her brain, all those coils, and her thoughts shuttling through those coils like fast, frantic centipedes. Like a child, I picture opening her skull, unspooling her brain and sifting through it, trying to catch and pin down her thoughts. What are you thinking, Amy? The question I've asked most often during our marriage, if not out loud, if not to the person who could answer. I suppose these questions storm cloud over every marriage. What are you thinking? How are you feeling? Who are you? What have we done to each other? What will we do? And then it gets darker from there. it really is very much as much a take on marriage and a look at at marriage and how it changes us and what it does to us in good ways and bad ways, and in this case, mostly bad ways. And the question becomes very quickly as Amy disappears on their 5-year anniversary, how much is Nick to be trusted? How much was he involved? What culpability does he have, and do we all have within things that go wrong in our marriage? So I'd love to just open with some questions and maybe go from there if anyone has anything about any questions about anything. Good.
I love Dark Places, and I was just curious if the scenes where you had the sort of murder club and people discussing
yeah.
it, which is chillingly real, are those real? Did you study that, or did you just kind of come up with that?
You know, I made that up. In the form, oh, sorry. The question is the Kill Club in Dark Places, and how much of that is it based in reality, and how much of that is fictional? In Dark Places, there is a group of true crime enthusiasts who gather, and some of them like to reenact famous true crime murders, and some of them just like to try to kind of solve unsolved murders. And the answer is it was basically a takeoff on. So a lot of the online forums and these online communities that do build up around famous cases. Just tonight when I was getting ready to come here, there was Piers Morgan was doing an update on the Casey Anthony case. And so there, you know, this is, you know, 5 years, I think, since that the murder. And people do build communities around some of these cases, and they get very involved and very emotionally involved. And so it was half of that and half of my the sad fact is the other half is that I wanted to have some sort of weird convention scene, and because I am a huge sci-fi geek and I go to conventions and I love to go to Renaissance festivals and dress up. and that is the dark secret. That's the darkest thing you'll hear here. And so I wanted that the idea of that kind of that the way that atmosphere is, how manic it gets and how crazy it gets, but I wanted it directed toward this incredibly dark thing. So, you know, I wanted a scene where people were dressed up as kind of famous murderers, and you know, that probably comes from the cinema buff in me, from, you know, being my father's daughter and having watched so many movies growing up, that there are always a few scenes in every book that I just know have to be in there because I can see them from the start, and they will find their way in there. And in Gone Girl, it's said, you know, during the recession, as the recession hits and unfolds, and I wanted this kind of bankrupt marriage to be in a bankrupt town, and so the town is a town that has been built around a giant shopping mall, and the shopping mall has gone bankrupt because of the recession, and so there's just this giant empty massive sort of Mall of America style shopping mall in the middle of this town. And As soon as I wrote that, I was like, we got to find a way to get in the mall. Like, I got to, you know, you got to go in the weird empty mall and have a scene there. And you know, it's every once in a while, I just have certain camera angles, even in mine, in certain shots. So that was a very long answer to your question, but thank you. Oh, excellent. Scene of the crime. You know, it has been optioned, actually. So it has been optioned by the producer who did both The Reader with Kate Winslet, and he's done all the Paranormal Activity movies, which I find incredibly eerie and disturbing. And old-fashioned, with that sort of just building sense of dread. So
who do you want to play?
Yeah, that's a very dangerous question.
She's so screwed up, but she's so lovable. You're just rooting for her the whole time.
Thank you. Oh, thank you. I have a real soft spot for Camille, I think partly because she was kind of my first narrator, my first person.
Thank you.
Thank you. You know, there I can't. I really shouldn't even say anything right now to weigh in to be polite to the process. But it has changed over the years because it's been, you know, 6 years since I've written it, and I will admit that the protagonists are never ever based on me, but I often picture myself as them, which is totally insane. But even the men I when I'm writing from like a male point of view, when I was writing Ben in Dark Places, that question was who would I like to play in the movie? And when I was writing Ben in Dark Places for a while, I had such a trouble figuring out how to write this teenage boy that I would kind of dress in like sweatpants and, you know, slouchy, you know, I wasn't like entirely dressed like a man, but I was kind of very aware of, like, I would even, you know, I felt like I changed the way I sat, and I would listen to different music, and I had downloaded a lot of Iron Maiden and I loved it.
When she writes in her diary, she is so what men kind of perceive and what people want us to be. But when we find out the real kind of Amy, she is kind of, you know, she's different. So, and you connected very well with my womanly side. I'm not a woman, by the way. Yeah, but I was just wondering if you... you don't have to do much research to be able to develop that character so well.
Yeah. So the question is just sort of finding Amy's voice and her journal entries and figuring out what she was going to sound like. And you know, it wasn't as much research. It really was. Gone Girl is a story of two voices. It's Nick's voice and it's Amy's voice. Both in the first person, on the day that she disappears, and as the case unravels, and Amy through her diary entries in the giddy first days of courtship, all the way through to where she disappears. And when you decide to do that, it's for male, female, first person narrators. You make a lot of extra work for yourself. What I wanted to make sure I did not do was that they just sounded like the same person. I think we all have that pet peeve where it just, you know, just because you say it's a different character and the voice sounds exactly the same, you know, it doesn't make it a different character. So I really wanted to make sure I knew them. So I do this a lot when I'm trying to figure out characters, which I do really weird, almost like grade school writing exercises for them. So I put out a list of questions, and it's literally, do they eat breakfast? What do they eat for breakfast? Are they the kind of person who would send a thank you note? What would be their last meal on Earth? What's their favorite book? What do they listen to on their iPod? You know, all those different questions. And I really forced myself to answer. You know, I try to get more and more trivial, because to me, that, you know, the devil's in the details, and that's where you really start finding characters. So I've so much unused stuff, you know, journal entries and I wrote even essays from Amy's point of view. I mean, I really overdid it, and I wish it were like a DVD where a director could put the the uncut scenes. I probably have another book in there of just like essays by Amy and Nick's childhood memories and all these different things that I used to try to figure them out. But that was important to me, especially because I'm not giving anything away, but you know, they're narrators that you're trying to figure out how reliable they are. And I'm a big fan of the unreliable narrator. I think there's nothing more queasy and uneasy than putting yourself in someone's hands and then going, are these people going to take care of me or not? You know, so thank you.
Mm-hmm. Did you write a bunch of Nick and then a bunch of Amy? You know, so did you keep Nick's thought going through?
No, I actually really alternated where I did. And that's mainly just because I am a sort of a disorganized thinker, and I don't need the added challenge of where am I or anything. So I tend to write straight through in a book. I rewrite and rewrite. But it was kind of nice to be forced to change the thought pattern here and there instead of writing all the way through. And then what I did was after, you know, I wrote the first couple drafts of the book, I would read each of their narratives separately just to kind of feel the flow and make sure it felt correct to where they were in the actual situation of the book.
Mm-hmm. I heard your NPR interview.
Uh-huh.
And did you live in Brooklyn at one time?
The question is, did I live in Brooklyn? I did. Okay. I did. I lived in New York for many years and Brooklyn for a little bit. And Linda Wertheimer, yeah.
Okay. That link of being in Brooklyn, being young, being creative, being part of the hot economy, and then it all crashing, mm-hmm. was very intriguing to the person who was interviewing you, as if it told a broader story about mm-hmm. people in or from or who had been in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get from other people that you've written sort of a type of New York story?
Yes. So the question is that part of the book, the early part of the book, is has both Nick and Amy as media writers and New York magazine writers in a very heady time when I was a magazine writer in New York, which was the late '90s, when man, it was great to be a magazine writer. And it was, you know, before the real rise of the internet, and we didn't realize that we were in a way on the last hurrah of, you know, the big print journalism boom. And it was a very personal story to me, and I did want to capture that time period of how cool it felt to be a kid out of school, and especially for me, you know, I was really from Kansas City, Missouri. I didn't even ever go to New York until I was about 25 or something, and so for me, you know, I remember moving there and like, there's Madison Square Garden, you know, on my way to work, and being a real, you know, sort of trying to be kind of cool, but at the same time, like, oh my God, look at this. I live by the Empire State Building. And trying to capture that, because Nick is like me as a kid from Missouri who went to New York and has the attendant chip on his shoulder about that, you know, about being kind of the lone Midwesterner in what is usually a very East Coast dominated industry, and to capture that feeling of what it felt like to be at that time period. So yeah, it was a fun time to revisit for sure.
Uh-huh. I also heard that interview. In fact, it was the first time I've heard of you.
Oh, good. The question is, what did it feel like, a big deal to be interviewed by Linda Wertheimer for NPR Morning Edition? And yes, the answer is yes. I was up almost all night. I was so nervous about it, and it was funny. I'm as you can tell, I'm not someone who speaks in full sentences all the time, and was kind of, you know, trying to get my thoughts together, and I was in the hotel room, you know, by myself at night, and trying to psych myself up, and then also then of course you hit that point like, you gotta go to sleep or you're not gonna be sharp, you know, for Linda in the morning. And it was funny, I was flipping around cable, and on C-SPAN came my hero Anna Quinlan doing an interview, and I was like, it was this great moment of like, I chose to see it as this lucky sign. It was like, oh, you saw your literary idol the night before you're doing, you know, your first NPR interview. So for me, it was very cool. Yes?
Do you get creative sparks during your average day?
Do I get creative sparks during my average day? Yes, definitely. Not sometimes when I want them, and often when I want them, I don't get them. But I do think my training as a journalist of writing for Entertainment Weekly for 10 years, where you're sort of turning something in almost every day, something is going through the system, and you don't you don't have the luxury of saying, you know, oh, the muse is not visiting me today. I'm going to relax and not write. You learn that you have to write, and it's very good training for a novelist because you have a lot of really awful days where the sparks are not coming. And then often I've had some of my best writing epiphanies on those strange moments when you're not doing anything remotely related to writing, sort of like trying to remember someone's name or a movie's name, and you wake up at 3 a.m. and it's like, Bob Schieber, I got it, you know. There have been those great moments where it's like, oh, I figured it out. I remember I was really struggling with sharp objects, and that was back when I was traveling a lot for EW, and I was on the set of Runaway Jury, which was a John Grisham movie with John Cusack, and I was doing a set visit, and it was this sort of courthouse scene, and it just out of nowhere, all of a sudden I had this complete epiphany, and I'm not going to bore you with what it was, but it was the strangest moment of you know, because here I was in the middle of, you know, doing my job, and it's kind of like, John, can you hold on for a second? I must scribble down my notes of my novel, you know. But I waited, but I got back to my hotel room, and I was just kind of frantically trying to get it all down because I'd figured out this really important scene. So yeah, they come all over the place sometimes. Yeah. I think someone here, were you?
I just wandered down here.
Oh, God, hi. Welcome.
I'm wondering if you could give me an elevator pitch about a novel that you've written that is personal.
Oh, the dreaded elevator pitch I'm being asked to give. I am not good at the elevator pitch because I feel like when I boil it down, it always sounds like something I wouldn't want to read. I always go off on sort of tangents, and then I sort of attach different barnacles of the story, and by the time I'm done, I basically have told you the whole book. But I will tell you that Sharp Objects is kind of my look at female violence and toxic relationships, and particularly how women express that sort of rage. And Dark Places has a lot to do about what poverty does to people, what really grinding poverty and a loose family structure and deep loneliness can drive people to. And Gone Girl is a look at marriage through the lens of a whodunit. So I hope you want to buy my pitch, my friend. Yes.
Gates or Arthur Brian?
Oh. I'm being asked to my Kansas City roots, Gates or Arthur Bryant. I am a Gates girl all the way. I grew up on that. One of the gates is not far from my home, and that was, you know, we can walk over there, and someone can wheelbarrow us back home. It's a good thing. Hi. Yeah. The question is that the narrator of Sharp Objects is a cutter, and where my research was, and I, if I have any personal experience with that, and I had known about that disease and had read a little bit about it, and just thought what an awful addiction to have. You know, I knew from the start that, you know, Camille, as a person who had grown up in a household where she wasn't sure, she knew something bad had happened, but she wasn't sure the extent of what was going on, and she'd grown up in a very repressive town in which girls were supposed to be very good and nice and shut up, that she would turn all her problems sort of inward and cut herself. But aside from that, I didn't interview people. I didn't read a lot, and that was because I didn't want to co-opt anyone else's story. It's an addiction like that is a very personal thing, and people now often share those stories with me, and that's a very important relationship for me to have with people. But certainly at the time, I was really scared if I talked to people, I would accidentally use some sort of detail that I didn't want to. So I really didn't. I imagined it, and that's the second part of the question. I imagined it. I have not ever suffered from that, from being a cutter.
But is there any reason why she always cut text rather than just random cuts here and there? Wasn't everything a
yeah. Yeah, the question is the nature of her cutting, and I don't want to give too much away for anyone who hasn't read the book. But again, I thought that was her only way of communicating. That was her way of speaking to the world. That sense of, I mean, I think we've all had those days where we're so depressed and feel so dark, but we look fine to people, and we want to It's like, I've only had something to show you, you know, about how bad I feel right now. And I think for Camille, that was the way of doing it, was expressing the psychological angst. Uh-huh.
And you mentioned one author that influenced you. Have you read any books lately that you're writing about?
I am in the middle of reading a fantastic book right now called Losing Clementine. And it's by a woman named Ashley Reach. And if anyone likes Dark Places and likes Libby Day, I cannot recommend this book. It's a really big, sarcastic, funny, dark voice of a narrator of a woman who's an artist who decides she's going to kill herself 30 days from the opening of the novel. And that makes it sound incredibly dark, but this. And it has some very dark insights, but this book has some of the funniest one-liners that I have ever heard. I mean, I was taking a bath before I came here. That's a weird thing to tell you all, but I was in the bathtub reading and was reading the book and literally was like, blah, blah, and like kind of almost lost myself in the tub with this one particular line that was so sick and hilarious. So I would highly recommend that. It's a good one. The author is Ashley Reach. Ream, excuse me, Ashley Ream, R-E-A-M. And I can start signing some books, or we can, chat informally amongst ourselves. Thank you so much. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.